Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
True Crime Horror Story contains extreme violence and adult subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
I'm your host, JD Horror, and this is True Crime Horror Story, Season 3, Episode 4, the True Crime Horror Story Halloween Special. Happy Halloween, listeners, and with me is the co-host of the True Crime Horror Story After Show and the creative force behind Mechanical Ghost that does our theme music and you often hear during our episodes, as well as one of the main researchers and writers of the show. Dom.
Hey, what's up? Don't forget that I also host Ghost Song Radio, premiering October 31st, Halloween.
Yes, so after you listen to this Halloween special, pop over to the True Crime Horror Story Network and listen to the debut episode of Ghost Song Radio.
I'll teach you how to hunt some fucking ghosts. It's going to be awesome.
We have kind of a special episode this week. We're going to be examining the murderous career of one of the most notorious slashers ever in American history.
This is someone who has almost more myth and legend than man. There's so much rumor and supposition surrounding his crimes. You know, it was an extensive research on my part. So I was like, if we're going to do this, I got to come on to be here to maybe dispel some of the rumors.
Yes, Dom, thank you for your research for this episode. And now we're going to take a little trip to a small town in Illinois to meet a murderer they called the Boogeyman. Part 1. A Monster Emerges. Michael Audrey Myers, also known as The Shape and the Boogeyman, was an American spree killer who committed his first murder in 1963 at the age of 6 and then went on a two-night killing spree in 1978. He was born on October 19, 1957, to parents Peter and Edith Myers. The Myers were an average white middle-class family who lived in a white two-story house located at 45 Lampkin Lane in the suburb of Haddonfield, Illinois. Publicly, there was no indication of the horrors to come, but privately, Michael began to show signs of being incredibly disturbed as early as the age of 4.
Michael's one of those rare cases where he actually didn't have anything in the McDonald triad. There was no bedwetting. There was no cruelty to animals. There was no head trauma, you know, none of that stuff. He wasn't even known to set fires. It just, like, all of a sudden, you know, around 4 years old, something just clicked in his brain.
Yeah, and seemingly coming from a normal, you know, meat and potatoes, white bread, American family.
Yeah, yeah, and there's a lot of rumors about the family, about how, like, the mother was, like, a stripper and, like, sleeping around and all that. But I couldn't find any evidence that any of that was actually true.
In January of 1961, the once quiet and polite Michael suddenly became hostile towards his older sister, Judith. He would often barge into Judith's room, steal her diary, and draw ugly faces and write obscene words on the pages. Michael would sometimes hurt himself and then blame Judith for it so that she would be the one to get in trouble. At times, he would just stare at her with a fixated expression for minutes on end. More than once, he was caught spying on her while she was showering or changing her clothes.
Yeah, that's not so good when that's your sister. I mean, it's not so good when it's anyone, but it's strange, though, because, you know, if he did have some sort of sexual fascination with her, it developed very, very early in his life, because usually, you know, at 4 years old, you're not thinking about girls.
About being a peeping Tom. Yeah.
Yeah.
Around this time, Michael was also having trouble in school. He was a smaller child who was frequently bullied by larger kids. He would take the bullying for a while, but eventually lash out with extreme, shocking violence. Mental health being what it was at the time, Michael's parents didn't know what to do about their troubled boy, and often they fought about it. While his mother, Edith, thought that family and church could solve the problems, his father, Patrick, wanted to bring in professionals. These fights always ended in a stalemate, and ultimately, nothing was done. This stalemate would tragically result in the deaths of 5 humans and 2 dogs, and untold mayhem.
It's very progressive that his father was actually like, we need to bring in someone, you know, professional on this. Because this was the 1960s. They knew things back then, you know, but the diagnoses were very vague and there wasn't a lot of good medication. It was usually just like, either send them to boarding school or send them to church and hope they get better, or send them to a mental institution and don't worry about him. But, you know, the fact that his father was saying this kid needs therapy in the early 1960s is really, it's kind of commendable. It just kind of sucks that his mom wasn't really on board with it.
Yeah, especially in a place like small town suburban Illinois. Yeah. You know, people didn't talk about these kind of things.
For sure.
In 1963, 15-year-old Judith was dating a boy named Daniel Hodges. In May of that year, Judith and Danny went on a camping trip to nearby Russellville, but Judith's parents insisted that she take young Michael along. At some point in the trip, Judith encouraged Michael to go play in the woods so that she and Danny could have some time alone, and that's one way to put it, I guess. Once they felt they had some privacy, Judith and Danny began to fool around in a nearby field. Michael disrupted his sister's lovemaking when he appeared before her, covered in blood, and holding a dead rabbit in his hands.
Worst cock block ever.
Judith was deeply disturbed by this, but didn't tell her parents. She didn't want to have to explain what she was doing and why she wasn't keeping an eye on her little brother.
Yeah, I don't think her parents would have appreciated that much.
On October 31st of the same year, the Myers parents went to a Halloween party, leaving Michael in his older sister's care. Judith sent Michael out trick-or-treating by himself so that she could invite Danny over. Michael donned his Harlequin costume, and that's not Harley Quinn either.
No, no, he didn't have on little booty shorts and a baseball bat. This is a 6-year-old boy.
But he didn't go out and collect candy like the other kids. Instead, he peeped through the windows while Judith and her boyfriend had sex. When Danny left around 10 o'clock p.m., Michael crept back into the house, retrieved a butcher knife from a drawer in the kitchen, and then barged into his sister's room. Judith was sitting at her makeup table, still partially nude, and brushing her hair. She barely knew what hit her as Michael descended upon her, madly swinging his knife. He stabbed Judith numerous times in the chest, torso, and abdomen. It's rumored that Judith's final word was her brother's name, though there are no witnesses to substantiate this. Michael left his sister to bleed out on the floor, exited the house, and stood in the front yard, still clad in his bloody clown costume and holding the gore-splattered knife.
Yeah, I read a forensic report on this, and they actually could not determine how many times she was stabbed. That's how badly that he went overkill on her. But most of the wounds were actually superficial, and it was the bleeding out that actually killed her.
Yeah, the crime scene photos of this murder are some of the worst I've ever seen.
Yeah, it's like someone just went in. I don't want to make light of it, but it looked like the aftermath of a GWAR concert.
This is where his parents found him, standing there, staring off into the distance, and not speaking a word. Michael was then taken to Smith's Grove Sanitarium, where he was to be held until he was 21 years old and could be tried as an adult under Illinois law. There, he became the patient of Dr. Samuel Loomis. For the next 15 years, Loomis did all he could to reach Michael, who had fallen into a state of catatonia. Many armchair psychologists and conspiracy theorists have attempted to diagnose Michael or explain his actions over the years. Theories have ranged from the more plausible idea that Michael had some sort of early sexual attraction to his sister and was driven to murder because he had to repress his impulses, to the less credible idea that Michael's family was descended from a bizarre Celtic death cult and he harbored some sort of demon inside of him and had to sacrifice his sister to dark gods on Halloween, aka Samhain, if you're dancing.
It's Samhain. Yeah, there's some really, really bizarre conspiracy sites out there. Like, there's all kinds of weird theories about how, like, incest was a necessary component of this ritual to keep demons at bay from coming to the earth or something like that.
Dr. Loomis came to a much simpler conclusion after unsuccessfully treating Michael for a decade and a half. In his book, The Devil's Eyes, Loomis wrote, "I met the six-year-old child with his blank, pale, emotionless face and the blackest eyes, the devil's eyes. I realized what was living behind that boy's eyes was purely and simply evil. Michael Myers is the most dangerous patient I have ever observed. This catatonia is a conscious act. There is an instinctive force within him. He's waiting." While moral questions of good and evil may be debatable, Loomis was right about one thing. Michael was waiting for something, and in 1978, the instinctive murderous force within him woke up.
Loomis is an interesting character. I think that treating Michael actually broke him. I've read his book, and he doesn't write like a psychologist. He almost writes like someone who's discussing religion and real, like, existential questions of good and evil. You know, early on, he was a pretty acclaimed psychologist, so probably early on, you know, he was into, you know, diagnoses and medication and all that, but he seemed really, really convinced that there was something beyond human consciousness happening inside of Michael and that it would shut itself off and turn itself back on.
I don't want to speak ill of the dead, but the way he kind of took this story and his interviews with Michael Myers and ran with it, you know, throughout the American talk show circuit, just try to capitalize off it as much as possible, it's kind of scummy to me.
Yeah, that's a little bit questionable. You know, it could be that he was just saying that to dramatize the situation a little bit and really kind of build up the story and the mythos a little bit more. But there are things that he did in real life, like, you know, we're going to go into it about him, you know, kind of taking it upon himself to actually get Michael back to Smith's Grove, that kind of makes me think that he did at some point, or at least on some level, believe some of the things that he was saying.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Part 2. The Night He Came Back. On October 30th, 1978, Michael Myers broke out of his room at Smith's Grove Sanitarium and released the other patients from their rooms. At the same time, Dr. Loomis and his colleague, Marion Chambers, arrived at the sanitarium to escort the now 21-year-old Michael to court for his trial for the murder of his sister. Michael escaped by stealing Loomis's car and driving off. Though no one was ever able to figure out when or how the previously catatonic person learned to drive.
It's an interesting question.
You watch people do it. I mean, there's stories of little kids driving their mom to the hospital. You know, they've never had necessarily experience behind the wheel, but
that's
you got to imagine there's a lot of stopping and starting and stopping and starting and hard jerky motions.
Yeah. Well, and he probably had been transferred from place to place, you know, at least a couple times. And who knows when he was in his catatonic state, what he was watching and absorbing. That's the only thing that I could think of is maybe he was shut down and non-communicative, but he was still vigilant in that state and was just able to absorb it.
Michael returned to Haddonfield. On the outskirts of town, he killed truck driver Christopher Hastings by snapping the man's neck with his bare hands. Michael then swapped out his mental hospital patient's clothing for Hastings' mechanic's jumpsuit. What made Hastings' death all the more unfortunate was that he was not even supposed to be working that night and was covering another employee's shift as a favor to his boss.
Makes me think of Friday. How are you going to get fired on your day off?
How are you going to get killed and your clothes stolen on your day off?
Yeah. And yeah, I actually did some reading on Hastings, and his whole story is super sad. Like, he actually wasn't even supposed to be in Haddonfield at that point. He didn't live there anymore because he had this fiance that he, on his bachelor party night, he got drunk and fucked a stripper. And he confessed to his fiance about it because he was so guilty. And she had to clear her head and went for a drive and got in a car wreck and died. And so like, this guy's life kind of sucked. So he left Haddonfield, but continued to work for this trucking and mechanics company, and had gone into Haddonfield to do a job. Just, you know, I think he lived in the next town over, and he'd gone into Haddonfield to do a job. And then the other trucker called in sick, or probably just wanted to party because, you know, it's the night before Halloween or whatever. And his boss, like,
Halloween Eve.
Yeah. All Hallows Eve, or, you know, Devil's Night or whatever, you know, the night before Halloween. But whatever the case, the guy that was supposed to work that night called in, and he was like, Hastings was like, I want to get out of Haddonfield, you know. And his boss was like, look, I need you to cover this shift. I'll pay you for the shift plus an extra $50. I mean, it was 1978. So like, $50 is different than it was now.
That's like 200 or something. Yeah. Now, right.
But still, like, he wasn't supposed to work that night. He was working an extra shift for a measly equivalent of a couple $100 and fucking died for it. That sucks.
Moral of the story, never take somebody else's shift.
Yeah, never.
Michael's next stop was the Haddonfield Cemetery, where he somehow managed to sneak in under the cover of night to unearth Judith's headstone and remove it from the graveyard. From there, Michael drove into Haddonfield proper. He stole some knives, rope, and a ghostly white William Shatner mask from Nichols Hardware Store. After obtaining his weapons in disguise, Michael returned to his family home on Lampkin Lane, which had sat abandoned since the 1963 murder of Judith Myers. Urban legend surrounded the house, and it was widely known as the residence of the boogeyman to local children.
Little did they know.
The house had been on the market for a decade and a half, with no buyers. While vandals had smashed out the windows and spray-painted graffiti on the outside, no one was brave enough to go into the house. It just sat there, rotting, the windows boarded up, with a spiderweb-covered for sale sign out front. Michael had no trouble breaking into the house and setting himself up there. A later search of the house found a recently killed and mutilated stray dog in one of the bedrooms. The canine corpse showed evidence of having been eaten, likely by Myers, and there was evidence of semen.
Dun, dun, dun. Biff?
Okay, I added that last one.
Yeah, so this house was that quintessential creepy house on the corner, you know, where the witch lives or the boogeyman lives or whatever. And, you know, usually when there's those houses, you know, kids dare each other to go in and all that. But apparently this house, like, after, you know, the murders and the Myers family left, it just sat and everything inside was dusty. But like, nobody had gone in and messed with anything. It was just the legend around it, even at that point, was just that scary to the kids.
It was at the abandoned Myers house that Michael first set eyes on the teenage girl that he intended to make his next victim. A police timeline puts Laurie Strode at the old Myers place on the morning of October 31st. Laurie was the daughter of Morgan and Pamela Strode, Morgan being a successful realtor in Haddonfield who had recently been saddled with trying to sell the Myers house. Morgan had asked Laurie to drop a key off at the house on her way to school. Both Laurie and a local boy named Tommy Doyle, who was walking to school with Laurie that morning, confirmed that she had dropped the key in the mail slot. If Michael had gone straight to his old house after stealing the items from Nichols Hardware and fucking the dog...
Gotta include the dog fucking.
That would have put him on the scene at least 30 minutes before Laurie had dropped the key off. It is believed that Michael saw her doing this and immediately fixated his homicidal urges upon her. There's much speculation as to why Myers became obsessed with Laurie Strode. A popular urban legend is that Strode herself was Michael's younger biological sister, who was secretly adopted by the Strode family after Peter and Edith Myers were killed in an automobile accident. According to legend, Myers returned to Haddonfield with the sole intent of killing his younger sister and finishing what he had started all those years ago. While it is true that Myers' parents had died in the accident, there's no official record of them having a third child. Another theory is that Michael saw Lori, and something about her reminded him of his older sister, and this is what sparked his homicidal desire. Lori and Judith were very different people, however. In physical appearance alone, Lori was a brunette with curly hair, and Judith was blonde with straight hair. Facially, there was little to no similarities. Even their body types were different. In terms of personality, Judith was an outgoing social butterfly with a rebellious streak, while Lori was much more reserved and studious. Judith was known to be promiscuous, while Lori herself was a virgin. Of course, Michael had no way of knowing what their personality differences were, because he had only seen Lori at that point, and knew nothing of the person that she was. Beyond that, Michael very likely lacked the capacity for empathy that it would take to notice any difference in personality. More plausibly, Lori was simply the first teenage girl that Michael had laid his eyes upon once he returned to Haddonfield, and he immediately conflated her with his sister in his mind. To a psychopath like Myers, all teenage girls would likely be the same.
Part of the whole sister legend comes from the fact, and this is actually true, like there are crime scene photos, not crime scene photos, but I guess it would be a crime scene because he escaped. But there are photos of Michael's cell from the night that he escaped. And he had used something to scratch the word sister into the back of the door of his cell. So a lot of people think that Michael had returned to Haddonfield to find his sister. And then because Lori was his topic of obsession, that she was the sister. But I think it was more likely that when whatever tripped in his brain and activated did so, he was just thinking about Judith and like carved that into the door.
Much of those reports leave out that above the word sister was twisted.
Rock.
That's all he wanted. He just wanted to go back to Haddonfield to rock.
Cause you're under the blade. Dr. Loomis, however, argues in his book that it's pointless to ask why Michael chose Lori. In Loomis's opinion, Michael's thoughts, if there were any thoughts at all, are completely alien to sane and rational people. Lori Strode had gone about her day, going to school like normal. That afternoon, she told her friends Annie Brackett, the daughter of the local sheriff, and Linda Vanderklok, that she had seen a large man in a mask staring at her through the window while she was in class, and that she thought that she was being followed. The girls were harassed by a mysterious person who was pacing them in a car, and Lori believed that she had seen this stalker watching her from down the street. Her friends made a joke out of it, not taking it seriously at all. Not taking the issue of Michael Myers' return seriously would become a common thread among the people of Haddonfield. After dealing with the red tape at Smith's Grove, Dr. Loomis tried to warn people that Michael would be returning home, but nobody would listen. Loomis took it upon himself to stop the escaped lunatic. Armed with his trusty Smith & Wesson Model 15 revolver, Loomis headed to Haddonfield himself. He stopped at a service station to call Sheriff Lee Brackett and warn him that Michael was coming, but Brackett took him for a crank and wrote him off.
Seems like a very, very common thread through most of Michael's life is no one really believing that anything was super wrong or being or willing to do anything about it.
It must have been those short shorts and the baseball bat and, you know,
yeah,
the red and blue makeup.
I wouldn't believe that either.
Though Brackett was an experienced police officer and definitely not some kind of Keystone cop, he failed to make the connection between Michael Myers and the theft of the knives and rope at Nichols Hardware. He did start to suspect something, though, when it was reported that Judith Myers' headstone had been stolen, though he thought it might have been related to the mysterious caller, Dr. Loomis. It was around this time that Loomis had arrived in town, and the two teamed up together to investigate the Myers house, finding evidence that someone was definitely living there.
Someone biting and fucking dogs. It's like a Marv Albert treatment. That's a throwback joke.
Marv Albert, huh? You ever see that Saturday Night Live with Marv Albert?
Yeah.
It's great to have the support of Rod. At that point, Sheriff Brackett started to see the whole picture and went out to patrol the town looking for Myers. Loomis opted to stay at the Myers house in case Michael returned.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Part 3. The Boogeyman Comes Calling. That evening, Laurie Strode was babysitting young Tommy Doyle at his house when his parents went to a Halloween party. Tommy, who was particularly afraid of the boogeyman and had been harassed about it by some of his peers at school earlier in the day, told Laurie that he saw someone standing across the street, staring at the house, but Laurie saw no one there. Laurie was trying hard to put her fears from earlier in the day out of her mind, and didn't see anyone when she looked out the window, so she chalked up the sighting to Tommy's imagination and the Halloween horror movies the two had been watching earlier that night.
Denial. That's the stage she was in at this point.
It ain't just a river. Across the street, Annie Brackett was babysitting another young girl, Lindsay Wallace. She was unaware that Michael Myers was also on the property, and that he had killed the Wallace family dog earlier in the evening.
Two dogs. That's how you know there's something wrong with that motherfucker. He can kill as many people as he wants, but dogs,
Yeah, you keep your filthy hands off the animals.
The dog was a German Shepherd, and he apparently killed it with his bare hands. This dude's got some strength.
Yeah, that's pretty hardcore.
Yeah.
Annie received a call from her boyfriend, Paul Friedman, asking if he could come over to the house. Preferring to spend Halloween with her boyfriend, Annie called Laurie and asked if she could watch Lindsay for a few hours. Laurie agreed to this, ever the helping friend, and Annie sent the girl over to the Doyle house. While getting ready to go pick Paul up, Annie was assaulted by Michael Myers, who had broken into her car and was hiding in the back seat. He strangled Annie into submission before slitting her throat.
That's another crazy crime scene photo. It looks like someone just took a bucket of red paint and splashed it all over the front of the car.
Yeah, it's almost too red, like it doesn't even look real.
Yeah, but apparently, like, he almost decapitated her. Like, that's how deeply he slit her throat.
Tommy Doyle happened to be looking out the window and witnessed Myers carrying Annie's corpse back into the Wallace house. Reasonably, Tommy lost his shit at this point and started screaming to Laurie that he saw the boogeyman again. And once more, Laurie looked out of the window, but saw nothing.
I bet Tommy Doyle's fucked up now. Like, he's probably still alive. But I bet he's had to go through a lot of therapy.
Yeah, for sure. Probably ruined Halloween for the poor kid.
Yeah, probably.
Soon after, Linda Vanderklok and her boyfriend, Bob Sims, pulled up to the Wallace house. Toxicology reports from their autopsies found that the two had been drinking for some time. They entered the house, likely looking to party with Annie and Paul. While the actual events that transpired in the house are not completely clear, evidence indicates that the two had sex in the master bedroom before encountering Myers.
You know who is lucky in all of this? Paul, because he never made it to the house.
Yeah.
He dodged a bullet, but he dodged a butcher knife for that one.
Michael stabbed Bob in the chest with a butcher's knife, with so much force that the knife went all the way through Bob's body and pinned him to the wall like an insect. Linda was killed in the master bedroom, strangled with a telephone cord. Myers wrapped the cord around her neck so hard that it collapsed her trachea. Oddly, a white sheet with two holes poked in it were found discarded on the floor of the master bedroom, along with Bob's eyeglasses. This wouldn't be so strange, as it was Halloween, and Bob could have been dressed as a ghost. But investigators found synthetic hairs on the sheet, which were determined to have come from the William Shatner mask that Myers was wearing throughout his killing spree, indicating that Michael could have been wearing the sheet at some point in the evening as well.
That's fucking weird. I can't even imagine. Like, I mean, I guess he had a sense of humor.
He's wearing a William Shatner mask, but then he's wearing a sheet over it.
Yeah. And possibly Bob's glasses. Yeah, I'm a murderer.
I don't know what I want to be for Halloween, so I'll just be everything. Star Trek ghost. With Dahmer glasses on. After putting Tommy and Lindsay to bed, Laurie went across the street to the Wallace house to see how her friends were doing. She found the house dark, without a living soul inside. When searching the house, Laurie found Annie Brackett's corpse in one of the upstairs bedrooms, sprawled out on the bed with Judith Myers' headstone at the head of the bed.
And that's actually an interesting one, because I think if Michael did have any capacity for empathy and was able to like actually conflate two people together accurately, Annie would have been more like his sister than Laurie would have, because Annie was apparently the outgoing one. You know, she was kind of a stoner and
kind of a skank a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, a little.
No one disparages the dead, but
well, you know how those kids of cops turn out.
You know what happens in a small town. Rumors go around fast.
Yeah.
And, it was said in the local media afterwards that Judith and Annie had a little bit in common.
And that's actually kind of fucked up. It's like they were trying to almost victim blame Annie. Like, if she wasn't a slut, she wouldn't have died. But I don't think that's true. Like, Michael Myers was in the house. He was killing anyone who was there, and she was there. If she wasn't a babysitter, maybe she wouldn't have died. But they're not going to say that in the news.
In a panic, Laurie fled, and it was here that she came face to face with Michael Myers, who slashed at her with his knife, but only managed to cut her on the right arm. This caused Laurie to lurch forward and fall over the banister and down the stairs, twisting her ankle in the process. Later in her testimony, Laurie had said that Michael moved so slow and methodic throughout this entire process, and her twisting her ankle might have been the only reason that she couldn't get away from him. You know, she just couldn't. She was limping around all night. You know, she couldn't break into a run at full speed.
Yeah,
he slowly stalked and approached her.
And that makes me wonder, though, was he messing with her? You know, if she's limping, he could have easily run and tackled her. And he was like twice her size. He was a big dude. So that kind of leads me to think that maybe he was like a cat playing with a mouse, you know?
Undaunted, Laurie pressed on to escape the house, but could not immediately get out the back door because Michael had blocked it by leaning a rake against the outside of the door and pressed against the doorknob like some kind of slasher Three Stooges.
Again, you know, it shows... You know, Dr. Loomis wants to say that Michael has no consciousness, no ideas, no thoughts, but things like that show that there was some premeditation and some planning on his part. You know, Home Alone hadn't been made at that point, so he had to think of that shit himself.
Despite the obstacle, Laurie punched through the glass and moved the rake, exiting the house as quickly as her hobbled ankle would let her. She ran to a neighbor's house and banged on the door, begging for help, but her pleas went unheard. Not wanting to stay in one place for too long, she ran across the street and back to the Doyle house, but found the front door locked. She pounded on the door, screaming for Tommy to let her in, as Michael methodically pursued her across the street.
As she banged on the door, she was yelling, "Tommy, can you hear me?"
Unfortunately, Tommy was fast asleep at this point, and Laurie had to throw a potted plant against his window to wake him up. Tommy let Laurie into the house, and Laurie told him and Lindsay to lock themselves in the upstairs bedroom. Laurie went to the phone to call the police, but found the line dead. Michael entered the house to confront Laurie in the living room, but Laurie evaded his attack and stabbed him in the neck with a knitting needle. This slowed Michael down, but it didn't stop him.
Yeah, the fact that the door was locked and the phone line was cut and all that stuff, that kind of makes me think that maybe Michael was in the house before Laurie went next door. You know, like maybe he went in there and set some stuff up, but it also, you know, he didn't kill the kids. So was he not a child killer, or was he not in the house? I don't know, but something in there doesn't add up to me.
He continued his pursuit, chasing Laurie upstairs. Laurie ducked into a bedroom and hid in the closet, and it didn't take long for Michael to find her in there, and he began to break through the closet panels. The ever-industrious Laurie quickly straightened a wire clothes hanger and stabbed Michael in the eye with a pointy end.
She's a fighter.
This caused Michael to stagger back and drop his knife, which Laurie scooped up and used to stab him in the stomach. Finally, Michael collapsed to the floor. Laurie rushed to the children and escorted them out of the house, telling them to go to a neighbor's house and to call the police. The children ran down the street, screaming for help, and they encountered Dr. Loomis, who had gotten tired of waiting for Michael to return home and went out to look for him. The kids directed Loomis to the Doyle house, screaming that the boogeyman was there.
It's crazy that Dr. Loomis was out there on foot while Sheriff Brackett and a couple cops were actually driving around patrolling in cars, and Loomis was the one who found him. Like, the sheriff was on the other side of town when all this shit was going down.
It's almost like serendipity.
Yeah.
Back at the Doyle house, Laurie was composing herself and getting ready to leave when Michael, apparently having recovered from being stabbed, grabbed her from behind and began to strangle her. Laurie clawed at Michael's face, ripping his mask off. This caused Michael to release her momentarily so that he could pull the mask back down. Booyaka, booyaka.
You know, when you're a luchador, you can never be seen without your mask. It's like a disgrace.
Lori tried to put as much distance between herself and Michael as she could in this split second. At this same time, Dr. Loomis entered the room and unloaded his revolver into Michael's chest, pumping 6 bullets into the maniac, causing him to fall backwards through a window and over a second floor balcony.
So he's been stabbed in the neck with a knitting needle. He's been stabbed in the eye with a coat hanger. He's been stabbed in the stomach with a knife. He's been shot 6 times, and he's fallen through a glass window over a balcony 2 floors.
Yep, pretty much.
Wow.
After checking on Lori, Dr. Loomis looked out of the window that Michael had fallen through, finding that Michael had once again escaped after all of that.
That's fucking crazy.
He has not been seen since. Many believe that Michael Myers crawled off into the nearby woods to die like a wounded animal. Urban legend says that Michael survived and is once again waiting for the evil force within him to reactivate so that he can return to Haddonfield and kill again.
He's just in the woods. They think it's Bigfoot, but it's him.
While it's very likely that urban legends are just campfire tales designed to scare kids, there's one final strange twist to this story. Following the 1978 murder spree, Greg Nichols, owner of Nichols Hardware, threw away the remaining William Shatner masks that he had in stock and never sold them or any masks manufactured by the Silver Shamrock Company ever again. The discarded masks didn't make it to the dump, though. They were almost immediately taken from the dumpster. While it's very likely that the masks were taken by local pranksters, like Michael Myers, they have never been seen again. There is a chance, however slim, that Michael himself took the masks and is still holding on to them and waiting. Wow, Dom, that's an intense story.
Yeah, crazy, right?
It's crazy that, you know, you hear a lot about your John Wayne Gacy's, your Charles Manson's, your Jeffrey Dahmer's. I mean,
right.
Michael Myers should be a household name by this point with this crazy killing spree. But I guess maybe because it was just one night of Halloween and then what had happened to his sister that it didn't become widespread knowledge. But, man, they should really make a movie out of this.
They should, yeah. I mean, and there's enough urban legends surrounding it. I mean, some of the urban legend is totally like incongruous, Lori was his sister and she died in a car accident after surviving him, but she had a daughter and he went after her daughter. All these conspiracy sites, there's like a story about how Michael Myers got a hold of Lori's daughter and got her pregnant. And yeah, I don't know, man, there's enough for a whole series here. It's nuts. There have been a couple books written about this, though. Of course, there's Loomis's book, but there's another one that's almost more of like a biography. It's called Blackest Eyes. And that's where I got the background information about him, like, you know, all the stuff with his sister that kind of led up to it, you know, with her boyfriend in the woods and all that. Like, that's not one of the more commonly told stories. But if you get that Blackest Eyes book, it actually has a lot of really, really good background information in it that a lot of people don't talk about.
And that's the story of the boogeyman, Michael Audrey Myers.
It's because he had the girl's middle name. That's what set him off.
That's what set him off.
Yeah.
In the first
My name is Dominic Justine Balsamo, but like I've only killed 2 people.
Not a lot has been heard about from Michael Myers since he escaped that night. Other than when he grew up to be a cast member in the 90s on Saturday Night Live. Party on, Michael. Party on.
I think probably the Love Guru was a bigger atrocity than anything he could have done in 1978.
Thank you for joining us, listeners, for our True Crime Horror Story Halloween special. We hope you enjoyed it. A little something different out of the show. A wink and a nod towards the season and one of our favorite horror movies.
Hell yeah.
This episode features music by Mechanical Ghosts and The Quiet Type, as well as artwork by Nuclear Heat Graphics, and was researched by Dom.
That's me.
Suggested movies similar to today's cases.
Oh, man.
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
I think there's about 6 of them and a couple shitty sequels and a couple shitty remakes. If you like what you hear here on True Crime Horror Story, consider joining our Patreon at patreon.com/truecrimehs. For as little as $1 a month, you can really support the show and get early access to ad-free episodes as well as exclusive bonus episodes and the True Crime Horror Story After Show, where Dom joins me and we break down the cases in a more lighthearted way.
I'm also going to be uploading early episodes of Ghost Song Radio to the TCHS Patreon with no ads. I'm not going to start my own Patreon for it. I'm just going to kind of tag everything into the TCHS Patreon.
Yeah, another reason to join the Patreon and get some more bonus content. And check out Ghost Song Radio, debuting today, if you're listening to this as it's new, on October 31st, 2020. We hope you enjoyed the episode. Happy Halloween. And like the boogeyman, Michael Myers, nothing can stop Halloween. Not even a pandemic.
And if you're really, really feeling the season, but you don't want to get out and you don't want to risk contracting a disease, that's cool. I understand that. But here's what you got to do before Halloween. You know, you got to obviously it's Halloween now, but, you know, maybe you can do this next year if there's still COVID-19 in Halloween 2021. God, I fucking hope not. But what you do is you take your mask, right, and you put it on over your face so that the lower half of your face is covered and you're not potentially spreading any diseases. And you go to the dollar store and you just buy bags and bags and bags of candy. If you can't go out, all you got to do is sit in your house and tear into that candy and just eat and eat and eat until you puke. And that is what we call letting the night roar.
Planet Earth about to be recycled.
We are all evil in some form or another, are we not? Evil has always existed. Perfect world most people seek shall never come to pass, and it's going to get worse.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18+.